Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can listen to this program anytime, anywhere in North America, that includes Canada, over the telephone. If you can't get to a computer or to a land-based station, 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. Today, no guest. I have so much information to share. I've written some commentaries. I'll be sharing some other commentaries, one from David Stockman via leerockwell.com, also one from Corey Morningstar from Counterpunch on Welcome to the Brave New World, brought to you by Avaz. Also, I'll be dealing with information from Dr. Helen Caldicott on Fukushima. Also from Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch on when the U.S. used cancer as a weapon. I'll share that with you. And then there's a typhoon right now right over Japan, and it's headed right for Fukushima. Let's see what happens today with that. I'll give you the latest on that. And new information that the United States media has chosen not to look at all. Turkish prosecutors indict Syrian rebels for seeking chemical weapons. I'll go into this 132-page indictment about six men from Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Nusra Front and another group that tried to seek out chemicals with the intent to produce a nerve agent, sarin gas. And so why is that in the rest of the world media, and we're not covering it? Let's begin. First off, always we start with health and nutrition, something that can empower us and allow us to live a longer and healthier life. A lot of people have skin conditions, and one most common is acne. There's some good new research out about tea tree oil. Now, tea tree oil is also called the Melaleuca tree. And if you've ever been to Florida, you know that in the 1900s, they brought in thousands of these Melaleuca trees because they absorb a lot of water to help drain some of the swampy area. And then they grow forever. They are the most common tree in Florida. Well, they also have something that they do. They give out an oil, and that oil has a powerful antibacterial and antiviral agent in it. And it was originally used by the Aboriginals. Well, the herb has been praised for hundreds of years because of its effectiveness against a wide range of organisms, such as fungi and bacteria and viruses. It'll definitely reinforce your immune system. In fact, one of the things I did is when I saw that there were some particular type of mites that invade beehives, I cleared the grass around the base of the beehive. I put the beehive up on poles about 4 foot high, and then I took tea tree oil, and I just put on a glove, and I soaked the glove in tea tree oil, and I rubbed it up and down the legs. Nothing gets up it, not spiders or wasps or anything, or mites or larvae, hence protecting the hive, because it's very strong, but did not impact the bees. By the way, I still have one beehive that's been producing since 1997. That's a long time for one beehive. And I don't bother, I let them keep all the honey, and I just happy they're pollinating. So anyhow, back to the tree oil, the tea tree oil. Now we know that it will reinforce your immune system and help protect against infectious disease like chickenpox, shingles, and measles, the flu, and the cold, even cold sores. And thanks to many studies conducted in the last few years, tea tree oil has a similar scent, by the way, to nutmeg, and it's obtained by steaming the tea tree leaves until you can press the oil right out of them. And tea tree oil works by killing bacteria and fungi on contact. Well, that also means it can do that on your skin. It has to be in a particular form that is already prepared so you don't burn yourself. But it's great If you're treating skin problems like oily skin, blisters, acne, abscesses, sunburns, athlete's foot, insect bites, rashes, warts, herpes, and dandruff. And the question is, can tea tree oil replace prescription drugs to effectively treat acne? Now, the answer to this question, from many point of view, is yes. Studies have shown that although it may initially take a little longer to see positive results, once it kicks in, not only is it on a par with the benzoyl peroxide, but most importantly, it'll limit the side effects such as irritations, rashes, burning sensations, or dryness. So if you've had acne before, you definitely will want to look into tea tree oil. And prior to applying a few diluted drops of the oil, it's recommended to test it on a less sensitive part of your body to make sure no undesired reactions occur. There was a study at Sweden's Shane University Hospital that showed that it fights off contact dermatitis. So that's good news for those people who have skin problems. Now, how I would suggest you do it is take a couple drops and put those drops into water and then massage just a little bit about the size of a dime on a part of your skin, might be on top of your foot, because that's sensitive skin also. And that way, if it you don't have a problem, then you could apply it to the face, but you must always use it diluted, never without dilution. We have a big problem in the United States concerning our guts. We just don't have enough good bacteria. And without good bacteria, you're not going to get the full digestion, absorption, assimilation of nutrients in the food we eat. Now, that's according to a new study published in Nature magazine, quote, from the University of Copenhagen. Scientists say that around a quarter of the population, particularly those who are obese, have 40% less intestinal bacteria than needed to maintain good health. They looked at people and looked at their gut bacteria. This was done at the Faculty of Health and Medical Sciences at the University of Copenhagen. Quote, not only has this quarter fewer intestinal bacteria, but they also have reduced bacterial diversity and they harbor more bacteria that cause low-grade inflammation in the body. So what does this mean for you and I? Why should we be concerned? It's simple. We need healthy bacteria. Healthy bacteria that then are in every part of our body. Remember, you have 100 times more bacteria than you have cells in your body. So we couldn't live without this bacteria. But when you give it sugar and coffee and sodas and buns and hot dogs, you're creating a bad bacteria. And the bad bacteria then leads to pathogenicity, meaning disease, where good bacteria leads to good health. So if you want to get started, at least get off all the refined carbohydrates, the processed foods, the junk foods, and then recolonize your intestine every day. Take about 5 billion, that's with a B, 5 billion good bacteria. That's not a lot. That's maybe a teaspoon of living bacteria twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. You can put it in your smoothie, and that's fine. And you can get non-dairy probiotics. And then wheatgrass juice, barley grass juice, chlorella, the good greens, help cleanse and detoxify the bad bacteria. And then healthy fruits, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, recolonize good things in the intestine. And then you start to have less bloating, gas, diarrhea, constipation, indigestion, and inflammation, the itises in the intestine. Also, we find that poverty reduces brain power. According to Medical News Today, it uses up so much mental energy that there's much less brain power left to address other areas of life. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. Consequently, poor people are more prone to make bad decisions and mistakes, which can worsen and prolong their poverty. Now, the researchers from Harvard and Princeton universities in the USA and the University of Columbia in Canada and the University of Warwick in the UK said that their study, quote, presents a unique perspective regarding the causes of persistent poverty. The state of being poor undermines a person's ability to concentrate properly on the avenues they should follow to improve their standard of living. Let's just be realistic. The daily struggle to cope with the immediate effects of not having enough money, such as cutting costs and begging and borrowing to pay bills, has a detrimental effect on cognitive function. An individual who lives in poverty ends up with fewer mental resources to concentrate on, and hence they don't have all the resources they need, and poverty robs people of an ability to manage their time. After performing a number of experiments, the investigators found that financial worries had an immediate negative impact on a person's performance in common logic and cognitive skills. They also found a 13-point drop in overall IQ. So let's just put this in perspective. What does this mean? Well, having just finished what will probably and arguably be the most comprehensive documentary ever produced in the United States on poverty. It's taken me almost 7 years. And it goes into post-production in about 2 weeks. Here's what I found. When you're poor, and let's now refer to the new poor. The new poor people who thought that they would never be poor. They worked hard. They were loyal at their work. Many of them had worked 20, 25, 30 years. And they had a standard of living that they enjoyed. And then their jobs were downsized or their companies taken over by corporate raiders. And they found that they were not quick enough. And this is across the board. I don't care what their occupation. This is what I found by interviewing thousands and thousands of people. They waited too long. They were the belief that their job would come back or another job similar would come back, or they wouldn't have to learn a new set of skills. They would be able to keep their old skills, and they wouldn't have to cut back too much. And those with families, especially those with teenage children, really found it hard to cut back because they didn't want to adversely affect the social position of their children in school, because they had seen in the feedback from the kids were, once you're considered poor in school, it changes the whole way people treat you and your opportunities. I'll give you one example. I interviewed a man who, and this is really interesting because I got down on the street in front of the university hospital and I filmed up at a man sitting on a curb. Looked like just a normal senior citizen in Florida in shorts and a shirt. And behind him was this mammoth medical center. And then beside that was a sports facility. And you could see, and I went from the man cut away to a close-up, and there on the wall was a plaque of the same man. This man had spent hundreds of millions of dollars in charity work. He had given it. He was very wealthy. But when the crash came in 2007 and 8, he did not move out of his positions the way he should have. He did not. He saw that no matter what happened, he would still be fine. Didn't happen. He lost everything. He lost so much that at one point he literally was homeless. He had no savings. He had no credit. He had no cash. He had no place to live. And all he had, he said, was a suitcase with some clothes in it. That's it. Could you imagine? So we were on a college campus, and I said, well, why don't you just go to the administration? Because all colleges and universities, they always set a certain number of rooms aside, apartments or homes for their faculty. I'm quite sure that they would set an apartment aside for you. After all, you gave them hundreds of millions of dollars. He said, well, I tried that. And they said, because I'm not a faculty member, they couldn't make any exceptions. So I thought, well, that's a tough response to hear in return. In any case, he found a place living in the garage of one of his former employees, and that's where he lived. And then he told me about all the other people he knew who were well-to-do, who now were struggling and lost their money. So I interviewed some of those people, and a typical example was a man who had two teenage daughters, one 16, one 17, and when he lost his job as an engineer, and his wife lost her job about 3 months later, they still had savings. They could still survive for a period of time, but they were absolutely certain after speaking with some headhunters they'd find another job with their deep experience and their advanced degrees. One had two master's degrees. But it wasn't to be, because what they didn't count upon is that there were thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of other people with even more advanced degrees willing to work. And then people who were hiring weren't hiring at the old wages, $155,000 for the husband, $161,000 for the wife. So as a result, they started looking for jobs with a little less. But by the time we realized it wouldn't be a little less, it would have to be a lot less, 2 years had gone by. In that 2 years, they had burned through their savings. They still maintained their standard of living for their daughters to keep them in their social circle. And then one day they realized they didn't have any savings left, that they were way behind on their bank, on their mortgage, and they got a notice of foreclosure. They only had about a month to make preparations, and they were so depressed they didn't. So when they finally got locked out of their door that morning, and they went to the school to pick up their daughters, all they had was their SUV, nothing else. Now he is working washing cars and she is cleaning people's homes. For he makes $8 an hour with tips, maybe 12. She makes $15 to $20 an hour. And at nighttime, they generally find room that they can stay someplace. But they waited too long. So I just want to say that when you have had that crisis, that's all you think about. How am I going to feed myself? Where am I going to sleep tonight? Where will I do my laundry? Where will I go to the bathroom? And as the man said, it doesn't take long when you impose upon friends and family, especially when you have teenagers, that you realize you shouldn't be staying there too long. Now multiply that times millions upon millions upon millions of Americans, tens of millions, and that's the current status. Little wonder, then, that they're affected in their cognition, you bet, and understandably so. And finally, something that will help the brain, exercise. This is from the Journal of Neuroscience, and here's what it says. It says, quote from Princeton University, "Physical exercise reorganizes the human brain so that it responds better to stress and normal brain function and is less likely to be affected by anxiety." Now, here's what I ask virtually all the people who I met who are the new poor. Are you exercising? Most said no. They're just too depressed. Are you eating right? No. Are you taking supplements? Can't afford it? Or no. They get into a very funky place. They get into this blue mood place. Because we don't teach in our schools, what do you do when your life runs into crisis? We don't have crisis prevention classes, and we should. That should be mandatory. We don't have grieving classes. What do you do when someone dies? We don't have that. Transition classes, when you have to start a new segment to your life. You have to surrender your old life, no matter how good or bad it might have been, and start a new one. I just counseled someone this morning I haven't seen in a long time, 4 years, who was going through a crisis back then and still in a crisis. And I said, you realize that you got to start a new story. Start from scratch. This time, learn the lessons and write a story that is positive each day, because otherwise you're looking over your shoulder to justify why you're a victim, and all you're going to see are people to blame or circumstances to blame, and you're not going to grow from that. We need classes on starting over. That would help us. Health and nutrition, our first segment. Now we're going to shift from there to the environment. I'm concerned that the American media has put attention on the think tanks and the experts they bring forward to give us their opinions on how to solve problems or even what the problems are. Not once have I heard anyone from MSNBC or any of the others talk about what we've done as an environmental disaster with full knowledge of its effects upon the people of Iraq and Afghanistan when it comes to depleted uranium. I've written articles on this. I've done 3 award-winning documentaries on this, including Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own. This is just one way that we can show how in the world can we tell everyone, stop hurting innocent civilians, which is a good message, but we're the ones hurting more innocent people than anyone else in America since 1945. Quote, at the close of the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein was denounced as a ferocious villain for ordering his retreating troops to destroy Kuwait oil fields, clotting the air with poisonous clouds of black smoke and saturating the ground with swamps of crude oil. It was justly called an environmental war crime. But months of bombing of Iraq by U.S. and British planes and cruise missiles has left behind an even more deadly and insidious legacy. Tons of shell casings, bullets, and bomb fragments laced with depleted uranium. In all, the U.S. hit Iraq with more than 970 radioactive bombs and missiles. It took less than a decade for the health consequences from this radioactive bomb campaign to begin to come into focus. And there are dire, indeed, severe consequences. Iraqi physicians call it the White Death, which means leukemia. Since 1990, the incident rate of leukemia in Iraq has grown by 600%. The situation is compounded by Iraq's forced isolation and sadistic sanctions regime, recently described by UN Secretary General as, quote, a humanitarian crisis that makes detection and treatment of the cancers all the more difficult. Quote, we have proof of traces of depleted uranium in samples taken for analysis, and that is really bad for those who assert that cancer cases have grown for other reasons, said the Iraqi health minister. So, this was just one article, and it goes on to talk about all the other munitions that we have used. Depleted uranium, by the way, is a rather benign-sounding name of uranium-238, the trace element left behind when the fissionable material is extracted from uranium-235 for use in nuclear reactors and weapons. For decades, this waste was a radioactive nuisance, piling up at plutonium processing plants. But by the late 1980s, there was nearly a billion tons of the material. And so they designed weapons through the Pentagon, and now that's what's used. So we have a massive, massive environmental mess in Iraq, Afghanistan, Croatia, where we've used these weapons, and it's killing the citizens. Also from today, there is a powerful monsoon that is hitting, as we speak, the center of Japan, flooding scores of homes, over 400,000 residents from 4 areas were asked to leave their homes due to the typhoon Manyi. And the typhoon was moving at 34 miles an hour, so it's going to be hitting Fukushima. Now, you would think that that would be important, but you would think that we'd be paying attention to Fukushima instead of other issues, but we're not, and we should. This is just one aspect published by Common Dreams. Quote, TEPCO official, Fukushima is out of control. And, quote, I'm sorry, but we consider the situation not under control, end quote. And those were the words of a executive level of the Fukushima plant operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, when he was pressed to explain the situation. Now, that's a direct contradiction to the claims of the Japanese Prime Minister, who assured the International Olympics Committee meeting in Buenos Aires that the situation is under control. It is not. And now, with this typhoon, now why should we be concerned about this typhoon? Well, because we have been told the facts. And the facts are very serious. And for those facts, here are what we should know at this moment. from the Washington blog, the fact that the Fukushima reactors have been leaking huge amounts of radioactive water ever since the 2011 earthquake is certainly newsworthy. TEPCO doesn't know how to stop the leaks. Scientists have no idea where the cores of the nuclear reactors are. Radiation could hit Korea, China, and the west coast of North America fairly hard. But the real problem is that the people who caused this mess are probably about to cause a much bigger problem. Specifically, the greatest short-term threat to humanity in the world is from the fuel pools at Fukushima. Now, if one of those pools collapsed or caught fire, it could have severe adverse impacts not only on Japan, but the rest of the world, including the United States. Indeed, one senator called it a national security concern. Now, the radiation caused by the failure of the spent fuel pools in the event of another earthquake could reach the West Coast within days. That absolutely makes the safe containment and protection of these spent fuels a security issue. Nuclear expert Arne Gundersen and physician Helen Collicott have both said that people should evacuate the northern hemisphere if one of the Fukushima fuel pools collapses. Gundersen said, quote, "Move south if that ever happened, I think is probably the lesson there." And former UN advisor Akio Matsumura calls removing the radioactive materials from the Fukushima fuel pools, quote, "an issue of human survival." So the stakes in decommissioning the fuel pools are high indeed. But in 2 months, TEPCO, the knuckleheads who caused the accident, are going to start doing this very difficult operation on their own. This is from the New York Times. Quote, "Thousands of workers and a small fleet of cranes are prepared for one of the latest efforts to avoid a deepening environmental disaster that has China and other neighbors increasingly worried, removing spent fuel rods from the damaged number 4 reactor building and storing them in a safer place." And, well, what happens if there's a mistake? What happens if they screwed up? Well, those can go, they can explode. And if that happens, you have 69 Chernobyls. And if that happens, you're going to have millions of dead people. All of Japan would simply be uninhabitable forever. It would impact China, Korea, the Philippines, and eventually it would affect the west coast of the United States. Now, here's what Helen Caldicott has to say on this issue from her latest post. "Endless Fukushima catastrophe, 2020 Olympics under contamination threat." Quote, "As the escape of radiation at Fukushima seems virtually unstoppable, there are still steps that governments all over the world should take to prevent worst-case consequences. One of them would be canceling the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. Scientific estimates predict that the radioactive plume traveling east across the Pacific will likely hit the shores of Oregon, Washington State, Canada early next year. California will probably be impacted later that year. Because the ongoing flow of water from the reactive site will be virtually impossible to stop, a radioactive plume will continue to migrate across the Pacific, affecting Hawaii, North America, South America, and eventually Australia for many decades. We're only talking about ocean currents, however. Fish swim thousands of miles and don't necessarily follow the currents. As noted, big fish concentrate radiation more efficiently, and tuna have already been caught off the coast of California containing cesium from Fukushima. Seaweed also effectively concentrate radioactive elements. As I contemplate the future of Fukushima, it seems that the escape of radiation is virtually unstoppable. The levels of radiation in buildings 1, 2, and 3 are now so high that no human can enter or get close to the molten cores. It will therefore be impossible to remove these cores for hundreds of years, if ever. If one of these buildings collapses, the targeted flow of cooling water to the pools and cores would cease. The cores would become red hot and possibly ignite, releasing massive amounts of radiation into the air and water and the fuel, and the cooling pools could ignite. It's strange that neither the U.S. government in particular nor the global community seem to be concerned about these imminent possibilities and exhibit no urge to avert catastrophe. Similarly, the global media is strangely disconnected from this ongoing crisis. Most importantly, the Japanese government until very recently has ostensibly refused to invite and collaborate with foreign experts from nuclear engineering companies and the governments. Now, Building 4, the structure was severely damaged during the initial quake. Its walls are bulging, and it sank 31 inches into the ground. On the roof sits a cooling pool containing 250 tons of hot fuel rods, most of which had just been removed from the reactor core days before the earthquake struck. This particular core did not melt because TEPCO was able to maintain a continuous flow of cooling water, so the rods and their holding racks are still intact, but geometrically deformed due to the force of the hydrogen explosion. This cooling pool contains 8,800 pounds of plutonium plus 100 other highly radioactive isotopes. Instead of this core melting into a larval mass like the other three, it sits exposed to the air atop the shaky building. A large earthquake could disrupt the integrity of the building, causing it to collapse and taking the hot fuel rods with it. The cooling water would evaporate, and the intrinsic heat of the reactive rods would ignite a fire of the zirconium cladding reacted with air, releasing radioactive equivalent of, are you ready for this? Listen carefully. 14,000 Hiroshima-size bombs and 10 times more cesium than Chernobyl. Not only would the Northern Hemisphere become badly contaminated, but the Japanese government is seriously contemplating evacuating 35 million people from Tokyo should this happen. TEPCO has constructed a steel frame to strengthen the shaky building in order to place a massive crane on the roof so they could extract the hot rods by remote control. This operation is always performed by computer and remote manually. Controlled extractions has never been attempted before. If the rods are deformed, a rod could fracture, releasing so much radiation that the workers would have to evacuate, and the chain reaction could be disastrous. So I'm giving you this simply because now you have a typhoon today. No one planned on that, but it's there. It's just stupid. Well, by the way, this is from the British Medical Journal. Quote, poor reproductive and birth outcomes in Iraq since U.S. invasion have received much global attention. A study by the World Health Organization and the Iraqi Minister of Health began in May to June 2012 to look at the prevalence of congenital birth defects in several governorates of Iraq and was scheduled to be released in March of 2013. The BBC documentary Born Under a Bad Sign offered a glimpse of the results of the World Health Organization report. They say, quote, all studies done by the Ministry of Health prove with damaging evidence there has been a rise in birth defects and cancers. Well, okay, and so what was done? Nothing. And what was the place of the United States in continuing to disown this? Nothing. That's unfortunate because there's a great deal that is bad to the bone. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Sleep late last night, and I dreamed that the night and almost half the day away. I just got up so that I could hear her say she's still in love, and no one could take her love away. Ooh, love wakes me up.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting a video streaming live from our studios in New York City. No guest today because I'm going to be sharing a commentary from the report, the corporate report, on another motivation for our interest in Syria that you have not heard in any of the media yet. We'll share this with you in a few moments. Let me also share the idea by David Stockman that Congress can do far more than stop a feckless tomahawk barrage on a small country which is already a graveyard of civil war and sectarian slaughter. I'm sure if any of you watch the Sunday Talking Heads, as I have, you see that these people are giving some certainty of cause and effect, and they have no credibility. These were the same people who told us what to expect in Iraq, and they were wrong on every single point. I believe that five decades of incessant meddling, bullying, and subversion around the globe has added nothing to national security, but it has left America fiscally exhausted and morally diminished. Indeed, the tragedy of this vast string of misbegotten interventions, from the 1953 coup against Mossadegh in Iran, through the recent bombing campaign in Libya, is that virtually none of these efforts involve defending America or any tangible link to national security. They were all rooted in ideology, that is, anti-communism, anti-terrorism, humanitarianism, nation-building, regime change, American exceptionalism. These were the historic building blocks for a failed pan or Pax Americana. Now the White House wants authorization for the last straw, namely to deliver from the firing tubes of U.S. naval destroyers a dose of righteous punishment that has no plausible military or strategic purpose. And by the president's own statements, the proposed attack, though it's now on hold, is merely designed to censure the Syrian regime for allegedly visiting one particularly horrific form of violence on its own citizens. Well, okay, let's stop for a moment. Let's say that we don't know right now with any certainty, because there's been no absolute proof, who caused the destruction to those hundreds of citizens in Syria. We do know this, for example, from today, that, quote, a court indictment by the Turkish prosecutors into the alleged use of chemical weapons by the Syrian rebels has once again highlarized fears this week that sarin toxic gas was used by the opposition and not the Assad government. The prosecutor in the Turkish city of Adana has issued a 132-page indictment alleging that six men of al-Qaeda-linked al-Nusra Front and also Ash-Sham tried to seek out chemicals with the intent to produce the nerve agent sarin gas, a number of Turkish publications reported. The main suspect in the case, 35-year-old Syrian national Kwasap, has been charged with, quote, being a member of a terrorist organization attempting to acquire weapons of terrorist organizations. The other five, all Turkish nationals, are being charged with, quote, attempting to acquire weapons for a terrorist organization. And the indictment alleges that he tried to set up a network in Turkey to order chemical materials for the al-Nusra Front, and citing telephone calls made by the cell, the prosecution believes that the group ordered at least 10 tons of chemicals. And then it goes on from there. Yet we don't hear about this in the United States, because it would disrupt the idea that there's only one guilty person there who should be punished. But shouldn't we also take a look in the mirror? After having rained napalm and white phosphorus and bunker busters and drone missiles and the most violent machinery of conventional warfare ever assembled upon millions of innocent Vietnamese and Cambodians and Serbs and Somalis and Iraqis and Afghans and Pakistanis and Yemenis and Libyans and countless more, Washington now presupposes to be in the moral sanctions business. That's downright farcical. Nevertheless, by declaring himself the world's spanker-in-chief, President Obama has unwittingly precipitated the mother of all clarifying moments. The screaming strategic truth is that America no longer has any industrial state enemies capable of delivering military harm to its shores. Russia has become a feeble kleptocracy run by a loudmouth thief and the Communist Party oligarchs. And China would face a devastating economic collapse within months were to attack its American markets. After all, who buys their sneakers and their Apple computers made in China? We do. They would simply implode, and they know it, and we know it. So the real question now, how is it possible that the peace-loving citizens of America, facing no industrial-scale military threat from anywhere on the planet, find themselves in a constant state of war? The answer is that they have been betrayed by the Beltway political class, which is in thrall to a vast warfare state apparatus that endlessly invents specious reasons for meddling, spying, intervention, and occupation, in pursuit of nothing more ennobling than raw self-perpetuation. The propaganda machinery of the warfare state, along with its media affiliates, such as the War Channel, which is CNN, and the War Press, which is the Washington Post and the New York Times, have over recent decades churned out a stream of vastly exaggerated threats, falsely transforming 10 pot dictators and tyrants into Ho Chi Minh, Daniel Ortega, Milosevic, the Taliban, the Ayatollah Khomeini, Saddam Hussein, and now Bashar Assad into dangerous enemies. At length, triggering incidents are concocted, such as the phony Gulf of Tonkin episode, the Madison Avenue-based fabrications about Iraqi soldiers stealing babies from incubators in Kuwait, and Saddam's repeated weapons of mass destruction. Eventually, the drumbeat for military intervention is cranked up to a fever pitch, and cable TV drives it home with non-stop talking heads. Only after the fact, when billions of taxpayer resources have been squandered and thousands of American servicemen have been killed and maimed, do we learn that it was all a mistake, that the collateral destruction vastly exceeded the ostensible threat, and that there remains no trace of a connection to our actual benefiting American people or its security. Now, setting aside the self-evident catastrophes in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, even the alleged good interventions are a farce. It's just an apologist from the warfare state. In the 1991 Persian Gulf War, for instance, only ensured that Saddam Hussein would not get the oil-filled revenues from what he claimed to be Iraq's 19th province, so that he could fund projects to placate his 30 million deprived, abused, and restless citizens. Instead, the loot was retained for the benefit of the despicable Emir al-Saba, the fourth, and a few hundred gluttonous Kuwaiti princes, all guilty of crimes against humanity and their own people. Yet in the long run, saving the Kuwaiti regime and its unspeakably decadent opulence did not lower the world price of oil by a dime. And it most surely subtracted from national security because it resulted in the permanent basing of 10,000 U.S. soldiers in Saudi soil. This utterly stupid and unnecessary provocation was the very proof that the infidels were occupying Islamic holy lands, and the principal excuse used by Osama bin Laden to recruit the few hundred fanatical jihadists and pull off the fluky scheme that became 9/11. And likewise, the so-called triumph of Kosovo is pure grist from the national security propaganda mill. The true essence of the episode was a mere swap-out among the ethnic cleansers. The brutal Serbian army was expelled from Kosovo so that the Albanian thugs of the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was on the terrorist list until it was mysteriously dropped in 1998, thank you, Bill Clinton, could liquidate minority Serbs and confiscate their property, a tragic routine that has been going on in the Balkans for centuries. The recruitment, the recurrent phony narratives that generate these war drum campaigns and their rationalizations are all just a part of the myth. A vastly bloated war machine and national spying apparatus, the imperial presidency and the House-trained lapdogs which occupied the Congressional Intelligence, Foreign Affairs, and Defense Committees. The triangle of deception keeps the American public bamboozled with superficial propaganda and the media supplied with short bursts of reality TV when the tomahawks periodically let fly. But it is the backbone of the permanent warfare state bureaucracy that keeps the gamut going. Presidents come and go, but it is now obvious that virtually any ideological script, left or right, can be co-opted into service of the Imperium. The Obama White House preposterous drive to intervene in the Syria tinderbox, with its inherent potential for fractures and blowback across the entire Middle East, is being ramrodded by the dogma of the responsibility to protect. Really? In that context, as chief propagandist Susan Wright and another Samantha Power are the moral equivalent of the Bush neocon hitmen Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz. In both cases, ideological agendas which have absolutely nothing to do with the safety of the American people were enabled to activate the awful violence of the American war machine, mainly because it was there, marching in place, waiting for an assignment. And the truth that encapsulates the inflection point now upon us, there should be no $650 billion war chest by the Pentagon with these groups able to do whatever they wish at the president's whim. The Cold War ended 25 years back, and like 1919 and 1946, the American war machine should have been drastically demobilized and dismantled long ago. It should be funded by no more than, I believe, $200 billion a year. The five destroyers, today menacing the coast of Syria should be mothballed or consigned to the scrapyard. No president need have worried about choosing sides among ethnic cleansers in Kosovo or Islamic sectarians and tribalists in Syria, because his available toolkit would have been to call for a peace conference in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, not a tomahawk strike from warships in the eastern Mediterranean. That there is no threat to America's security lurking behind the curtain in the Middle East, only a cacophony of internal religious, ethnic, and tribal nationalist conflicts that will eventually burn themselves out, rather than the new caliphate of Fox News' demented imagination. The truth on the ground is that the Islamic world is enmeshed in a vicious conflict pitting the Shia's axis of Iran, Syria, southern Iraq, and the Hezbollah-Lebanon corridor against the surrounding Sunni circle, which is nominally aligned with the Syrian rebels. Yet even the Sunni world is noisily fracturing, with Turkey and Qatar lined up with the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states aligned with the Egyptian generals. Meanwhile, Jordan cowers in the shadows. The cowardly hypocrisy of the Arab League should tell the congressional rank and file all they need to know about why we should stay out of Syria and shut down the CIA-sponsored rebel training camps in Jordan, through which Saudi arms, including chemical weapons, according to some reports, are being injected into the slaughter in Syria. And that's just some of the thoughts on that. I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to save the commentary on the part of why we're really in Syria for tomorrow. So tomorrow you'll have that. By the way, on my Progressive Commentary Hour this evening at 7 p.m., it'll be a Conversations with Remarkable Minds. It'll be beyond the Occupy movement, the need to spiritualize political, social, and environmental activism towards building a post-capitalist society. Dr. David Corton, co-founder of Yes Magazine, will be there. Reverend Matthew Fox, one of the nation's most progressive theologians and spiritual visionaries, will have an interesting panel. I'm sure that many of you are looking at what's going on saying, it almost seems like 1984. Well, it's more than that, according to Corey Morningstar. Neil Postman, who's a social critic, compares the worlds of 1984 and Brave New World. I'm sure all of the baby boomers in this audience read both. And here's what he says, quote, in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who would want to read. Orwell feared that those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared that those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egotism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the orgy-porgy and the centrifugal bumble puppy. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World, revisited, the civilian libertarians and rationalists, who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny, failed to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we fear will ruin us. Huxley feared that our desire will ruin us, end quote. Well, it's all familiar. Notice that nonstop breaking news on all the media outlets, how easily the current puppet in the belly of the beast of industrial capitalism dances to the tunes played by the corporate shareholders pulling the purse strings. Note how every single day, sometimes more than once a day, some new piece of so-called news is brought to the public for all of us to swallow, just as Aldous Huxley predicted. He said, quote, there will be in the next generation or so a pharmacological method of making people love their servitude and producing dictatorships without tears, so to speak, producing a kind of painless, concentration camp for entire societies so that people will in fact have their liberties taken away from them, but would rather enjoy that. Aldous Huxley has proven to be quite prophetic in his predictions of the future. There is in fact a pharmacological method of making people love their servitude, precisely because of what Huxley prophesies. Quote, there will be distracted from any desires to rebel by propaganda or brainwashing enhanced by pharmaceutical methods, and this seems to be the final revolution. You think? Of course the pharmacological method Huxley spoke about does not constrain itself to pharmacological agents alone. Today, we can expand the pharmacological method and use of terrorism that Huxley spoke of to the stealthily state-of-the-art psychological warfare waged against the public psyche by mainstream media, in tandem with the non-profit industrial complex. As an unparalleled set of multiple crises of the most epic proportions looks down upon us, right before it crushes us, it appears that this may very well be the final revolution Huxley spoke of, from manufactured faux revolutions that are embraced and celebrated by the Western left, to the oncoming climate holocaust, which we collectively address by not addressing it, convincing ourselves that we need not discuss the very root cause of our accelerating crisis, the industrialized capitalist economy crushes itself, our fake profits within the non-profit industrial complex service, and our insatiable appetite for lies, insidiously assuring us that the same system destroying us will now save us. And then everybody at MSNBC and the left applauds. The philanthropic colonization of the collective is complete. Wasn't it the great philosopher and cultural critic Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on I can't believe you. Today's collective society and cohesive acquiescence says, I'm not upset you lied to me. I'm grateful that your lies allow me to maintain my privilege. I'm grateful that our collective acceptance of cognitive dissonance allows us, and in fact encourages us as a society, to embrace our lies. I'm grateful that the acceptance of lies has evolved to be mainstream, avant-garde, and status quo. I'm grateful that I can get back to my TV show now. Thank you. The normalization of lies and complete indifference has never been so vague or in so much a celebration. Anyone who does not kowtow to the line of resolute false hope is labeled divisive and is isolated and ridiculed by the obedient, the indoctrinated. Thus, the 21st century critical thinker of today must always be cognizant that the masses have never thirsted for truth. They turn aside from evidence that is not to their taste, preferring to deify error if error seduces them. Whoever can supply them with illusions is easily their master. Whoever attempts to destroy their illusions is always their victim. And that was from Gustav Le Bon, who died in the 1930s. In conclusion, our entire belief system, built upon a foundation of lies and conditioning, is now cradled, even cultivated, by collective society itself. However, if this state-of-the-art web of deception, held together only by the most intricate, seemingly fragile web of lies, were to start falling apart, we would witness the inevitable unraveling of the entire system and the existing power structures within it. But one must be cognizant of the fact that the tensile strength of spider silk is greater than the same weight of steel. Thus, the entangling work will not be easy. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm thankful for those of you who've taken your time to listen and share your insights by using this information in a constructive way and passing it on. I was inspired this morning to see how many people are listening over the telephone at our 619-550-0869. I was inspired to see that under Google search engine, we're number one under liberal radio, number one under progressive commentaries. Independent thinkers, people who have critical judgment, are coming by the thousands each day, new, brand new, every day, and joining all those who have come before and sharing this information without a single article, a single piece of publicity, not a single interview anywhere, just word of mouth. And I thank you for that, because we, meaning we who are independent thinking, we're still relevant, and we're looking for solutions, and we're finding them. Now let's go to Talk Back, your chance to call in and share your points of view. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And our first person up is Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hello, Gary. Two quick things. One is you are spot on, dead right about what's happening in Japan with the typhoon. BBC is about the only news place that's even talking about it. And very, really brief, you know, 30-second thing on maybe CNN or something. Really amazing stuff. Anyway, on an up note, I am still interviewing people to come down for your upcoming retreat. That is amazing. Just the nicest people are coming down. We have people that are coming for one-month study, people that want to reverse chronic illnesses that have not had luck so far in conventional medicine. Just really nice people. In fact, if people are trying to get on board and they're not nice, we send them back. We don't want them there.
No, there are places for people who need help detoxing, and you give them a list of those other places. We have some simple criteria. Be a nice person, act in a nice way, and really come with the idea of change. People coming with a chip on their shoulder, they're not going to benefit. I don't want to see people waste their money. I don't want to see people waste their time. And I don't want to run around trying to stop people from interfering with people who are there for the right reason. So if you don't have a good attitude, don't call. If you do and want to change your life, then call. Let me put this in perspective. Right now, we have a lot of people who want to change, get healthy and happy, de-stress, and really focus, maybe for the first time in their life, on a quality input where they can choose what they want to bring into their life, whether it's juicing, detoxing, meditation, yoga, exercise, where they can be a healthier person for the future. And those are the people that we're encouraging to call. This is also a fundraiser for WBAI, and it will help the station, which desperately needs funds. So that's what we're going to do now for the month. That's the one are coming from the health support group for a weekend. Just imagine waking up in the morning, going for a wonderful power walk with John Q showing you how to power walk in the country, looking at horses and cattle and sheep and the pastures, very bucolic. Imagine doing water aerobics, and especially if you're overweight or have stress in your joints where you couldn't do regular exercise, you can. Imagine then getting your special personalized training in a gym, having the juices, about 15 different types of juices a day or 15 glasses of juice throughout the day, gourmet meals, cooking classes, gardening classes, sprouting classes, microgreen classes, artist healing classes, meditation classes, and personal counseling from you throughout the day. Where are they going to get that? There's no place to get all this in this beautiful environment that has been taken over for this 1 month. And I go around the country and I look for the most beautiful environments to rent for a week or a weekend or a month, however long it is. And this is the last one we're doing for a long time because my schedule doesn't allow me to do any more right now. I got too many things happening. So if you want to come and join us, and I'll be there the whole time for not just the 1 week, but the whole month, if you want to come, just give Lou Ann a call. Give your number, Lou Ann.
Surely. It's 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. Give me a call.
Good. And we're out of time. Let me mention that tonight we're going to take on the need to spiritualize political, social, and environmental activism towards building a post-capitalist, greed-based society. It'll be an interesting discussion with some of the finest minds in the country. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Luann, if you're still there. Today we'll be talking about President Obama's famous red line on chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction, which just disappears with respect to Israel.
Okay, we look forward to that. Utrice Lead coming right now.